If you don't wish to be compelled by the state to support a woman's choice to kill her child, then ask God to move you with love to assist a woman in raising her child. And likewise, for the terminally ill patient contemplating physician-assisted suicide, or for the sexually troubled who desire intimacy wrongly from persons of the same sex. Ultimately, it is not simply a contest between them and us, but rather it is a calling. It is a calling for us to serve them, to show them how the coercive reality behind their pro-choice rhetoric entraps not only us, but also and especially themselves. It is a calling to help them break free from the sorrow, from the pain, from the confusion, from the guilt that would drive them towards such choices in the first place. Please consider carefully what it must mean in early 21st century America for Christian people like yourselves to live as the salt and the light of the world.
The following podcast is brought to you by Ryan C. McPherson, PhD. Dr. McPherson is a nationally recognized author and speaker who teaches college courses in American history, constitutional law, science, theology, and culture. To learn more, visit www.ryancmcpherson.com. That's www.ryancmcpherson.com.
I begin in the year 1850. The place was the American West. The issue was slavery, and the contest was for the future of a nation. 2 years prior, the United States had concluded a war with Mexico, resulting in the acquisition of territory that today comprises six southwestern states. Residents of the California Territory applied for statehood in 1849. They submitted for congressional review a proposed constitution containing this provision: neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, unless for the punishment of crimes, shall ever be tolerated in this state. Congress accepted California as a free state in 1850, but during the same year voted to permit slavery in the New Mexico and Utah territories, if the settlers there desired it. Meanwhile, Congress hotly debated whether to allow slavery in Washington, D.C. As auctioneers sold African slaves just outside the Capitol building, Congress at last resolved to permit the continuation of slavery within Washington, D.C., while at the same time forbidding any further slave trade between the District of Columbia and other slave regions. But the most controversial piece of legislation in what became known as the Compromise of 1850 was the Fugitive Slave Act. The federal constitution, as ratified in 1788, included a fugitive slave provision, according to which states that forbade slavery within their own borders were nonetheless required to lend reasonable assistance to slaveholders from other states whose runaway slaves had fled to that state. The Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 elevated this reasonable assistance to a new level, and it did so at a time when Americans were more divided than ever over the moral, political, and social ramifications of slavery. This new fugitive slave law coerced northern opponents of slavery to participate in the perpetuation of slavery by avoiding acts that would liberate slaves and by committing acts that would return into slavery those who had run away and fled from it. Moreover, in cases wrongfully decided, the law required northern abolitionists to participate in the enslavement of legitimately free blacks who had been mistaken as escaped slaves. Admitting a surprisingly blatant bias, the law offered financial incentives to federal commissioners who were paid twice as much if they decided disputes in favor of the slaveholder rather than in favor of the supposed runaway slave. The law specifically required both federal agents and ordinary U.S. citizens to comply with its provisions on behalf of slaveholders. Any person found to assist a runaway slave in any manner, whether directly or indirectly, could be fined up to $1,000, imprisoned up to 6 months, and required to reimburse the slaveholder for the value of that human property. These provisions infuriated Northern abolitionists, who had been calling for the abolition of slavery for 2 decades. They also infuriated moderate Northerners, who had been willing to tolerate slavery in the South so long as it did not expand into the rest of the Union. Amid such sharp political divisions, one politician believed that he could hold the nation together, Senator Stephen Douglas of Illinois. It was Douglas who had orchestrated the Compromise of 1850, letting one side have a free California and the abolition of slave trade in Washington, D.C., while letting the other side have the prospect of slavery's expansion into the West and the continuation of slavery in the nation's capital. The Fugitive Slave Act, however, left the political balance leaning eerily in favor of the slaveholders. Even so, Senator Douglas tried to maintain common ground throughout the 1850s. He did so primarily by advocating freedom of choice, but his efforts ended in utter disaster. Promoting a slogan of popular sovereignty, Douglas proposed, in 1854 that the Kansas and Nebraska territories should be organized under the principle of local representative democracy. Let the settlers themselves decide whether to allow or to forbid slavery. Congress should not restrict their freedom of choice. Few proposals could sound so quintessentially American, and yet no proposal would prove so dangerous to the American Republic as the Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854. What Congress accepted in the name of allowing local populations the freedom of choice soon manifested itself as a coercive effort by one faction to dominate its political opponents. As a legislature formed out of pro-slavery advocates in Lecompton, Kansas, they prepared a constitution to apply for statehood. In addition to guaranteeing slaveholders the right to own slaves, they also took steps to prevent slavery's opponents from gaining a foothold in their slaveholding society. The Lecompton legislature made it a felony to publicly question, whether in speech or print, the right of slaveholders over their slaves. Slavery's opponents also were forbidden from serving as jurors in cases on this topic. It was clear that slavery would remain intact wherever the slaveholders wanted it. But could that principle apply also to free areas? Could a slaveholder claim a right to a slave even in a northern state or in a free territory where slavery was forbidden by law? A man named Dred Scott thought not. Scott, a slave from Missouri, had been brought by his master into the free state of Illinois and the free territory at that time called Wisconsin, actually present-day Minnesota, at Fort Snelling. While working for his master or rented out to others in these slave-banning, slave-prohibiting parts of America, Scott had been trusted to travel without supervision. He had been granted a civil marriage to the woman that he loved. In brief, he had enjoyed core characteristics of freedom. And so he petitioned, first to the courts of Missouri and later to the federal courts, to be declared a free man, liberated forever from slavery. The history of British and American jurisprudence was on his side. Lord Mansfield had rendered a verdict in England in 1772 that the moment a slave set foot on a free territory where slavery is outlawed, he became forever a free man. His reasoning was that slavery is so contrary to human nature that it cannot possibly exist in any society unless that society enacts laws to create and preserve it. Similarly, courts of several southern states, including Missouri, had ruled in favor of slaves' petitions for liberation during the 1820s and the 1830s. Turning its back on these case precedents, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in Dred Scott versus Sanford that Scott remained the property of his master, who had the right to travel with him throughout the United States in both slave zones and free zones, even as a man may travel with his horse or other piece of property. Nullifying federal law, the nation's high court declared that slavery must be protected in all territories. But this judicial victory for Southern slaveholders also would lead to their demise. For in affirming the right of a slaveholder over his slave, even in a place where the law prohibited slavery, the court had denied Senator Douglas's doctrine of popular sovereignty. In place of the people's choice to either have or not have slavery, the court had issued a federal mandate coercing slavery to be recognized even in places where the people loathed it. The coercive politics of slavery, manifesting itself now through both the Fugitive Slave Act and the Dred Scott decision, betrayed the Southerners' pretension to be defenders of liberty and of states' rights. Their peculiar institution, their Southern way of life, depended for its very existence not upon the states being left free to decide for themselves, but upon a federal government that would enforce slave laws, even in those northern areas where the local population loathed slavery. And it was precisely this realization, this demise of Stephen Douglas's popular sovereignty compromise that Abraham Lincoln brought before the American people in his campaign for the presidency. His election would prompt 11 southern states to secede from the Union. South Carolina explicitly based its secession on the failure of the federal government to enforce the Federal Fugitive Slave Act among the states that did not wish to promote or support slavery. The Confederate Constitution accordingly included a stronger and clearer fugitive slave policy, echoing the Dred Scott decision. It also required that all states entitle citizens from each state the right to transit and sojourn in any state of this Confederacy with their slaves and other property, and the right of property in said slaves shall not be thereby impaired. The Confederacy's Constitution forbade its Congress from enacting any law denying or impairing the rights of slavery. This new Constitution also required that state laws be subordinate to federal law and to this federal slave-protecting Constitution. Rather than reserving slavery as a state's right, as Douglas's doctrine of popular sovereignty would have had it, the Confederate States of America charted a course in which a new federal government, that of the Confederacy, would ensure slavery's continued existence. In its short-lived history from 1861 to 1865, the Confederacy demonstrated itself as a coercive national force, intent upon preserving the right of slaveholders to keep Africans as property. As one American history textbook notes, the Confederacy reached levels of government involvement unmatched until the totalitarian states of the 20th century. In part, this was a wartime necessity. The industries were nationalized for wartime production. Taxes were collected on imports, exports, and incomes. But state coercion also went deeper, suppressing freedom of speech and freedom of the press by labeling arguments against slavery as treason. What may have begun as a question of personal liberty, to transport one's own property and slaves from one state to the next, or as a state's right to regulate its own peculiar institution, had become a national policy that had no toleration for dissent. The protection of a slaveholder's choice to own another human being required the coercion of an entire society by the force of federal law. Or, as Lincoln had observed as early as his House Divided speech of 1858, if one man choose to enslave another, no third man shall be allowed to object. This government cannot endure permanently half free and half slave. It will become all one thing or all the other. In the Confederate States of America, it had become forcefully all slave. With brilliant foresight, Lincoln had seen it all coming. A moderate on issues of slavery, and certainly not an eager proponent of social equality between the races, Lincoln would try to maintain peace for as long as he could. But already in his presidential campaign speech at Cooper's Union, New York, February 1860, Lincoln identified the root of the Civil War that soon would erupt. Listen now to Lincoln's words. What will satisfy them? Simply this. We must not only let them alone, we must somehow convince them that we do let them alone. What will convince them? This and this only. Cease to call slavery wrong and join them in calling it right. And this must be done thoroughly. done in acts as well as in words. Silence will not be tolerated. We must place ourselves avowedly with them. Senator Douglas's new sedition law must be enacted and enforced, suppressing all declarations that slavery is wrong, whether made in politics, in presses, in pulpits, or in private. We must arrest and return their fugitive slaves with greedy pleasure. We must pull down our free state constitutions. The whole atmosphere must be disinfected from all taint of opposition to slavery before they will cease to believe that all their troubles proceed from us, holding as they do that slavery is morally right and socially elevating. They cannot cease but to demand a full national recognition of it as a legal right and a social blessing. I speak to you this evening in the spirit of Abraham Lincoln, who identified the coercive reality behind the pro-choice rhetoric of his day. Back then, debates over slavery gripped the nation's conscience. Today, other issues polarize our politics. Arguably, abortion, physician-assisted suicide, and homosexuality rank at the top of that list. Just as Lord Mansfield had claimed that slavery could not exist in any society unless laws were passed to promote it, so also I am of the opinion that neither abortion, physician-assisted suicide, or homosexuality can receive widespread or long-lasting social acceptance unless the force of law makes it so. More specifically, I endeavor to persuade you this evening that abortion, physician-assisted suicide, and homosexuality cannot comfortably exist in American society unless the individual liberties of a significant portion of our population suffer severe restrictions. My thesis may seem entirely wrong-founded to some of you, and I readily admit its counterintuitive character. Americans of the late 20th and early 21st centuries have become accustomed to viewing abortion as a question of private choice, not public coercion. The same sort of pro-choice rhetoric that has championed a woman's right to abort her child also has been used to permit terminally ill patients the right to physician-assisted suicide. Once again, the language of individual freedom of choice has been heralded in favor of homosexuality, in favor of unions between two people of the same sex that now claim for themselves the title marriage. But I wish to scrutinize the sincerity behind the often recited claim that abortion, physician-assisted suicide, and homosexuality should be tolerated because our national commitment to individual liberty supposedly necessitates it. In questioning the sincerity behind the pro-choice arguments offered in defense of these practices, I do not question the sincerity of the persons making those claims. I merely assert that those who are sincere also are mistaken. To state my thesis again, I endeavor to persuade you this evening that abortion, physician-assisted suicide, and homosexuality cannot comfortably exist in American society unless the individual liberties of a significant portion of our population suffer severe restrictions. My title thus summarizes my message, the coercive reality behind pro-choice rhetoric. Commentators frequently cite Roe versus Wade as the landmark Supreme Court case that legalized abortion. More precisely, it nationalized abortion, an activity that already was legal in most states. On the eve of the Roe decision, 31 states already permitted abortion when necessary to save the mother's life. 13 states had legalized abortion for broader considerations, including rape, incest, and the mother's psychological well-being. A New York law outlawed abortion on demand, or rather permitted abortion on demand, up to the 24th week of pregnancy. This was in 1970. The prevailing argument behind the New York law relied on recently coined phrases, including a woman's right to choose, pro-choice, and reproductive freedom. Dr. Bernard Nathanson introduced these expressions while working with the National Association for the Repeal of Abortion Laws. Despite his lip service to choice and freedom, Nathanson himself was trapped in a dismal culture of death. Raised by a controlling father, he entered medical school to fulfill parental expectations. After impregnating his girlfriend, he accepted a $500 gift from his father to pay for her abortion. The night before the abortion, we slept together, huddled in each other's arms. We both wept for the baby we were about to lose and for the love we both knew would be irreparably damaged by what we were about to do. They soon parted ways, and Nathanson married another woman whom he later admitted he also did not love. After divorcing his first two wives and impregnating a new girlfriend, Dr. Nathanson performed the surgery to abort his very own child. Then, in the wake of legalization, hospitals became overwhelmed by the demand for first trimester abortions. Dr. Nathanson therefore pioneered an outpatient technique that would allow clinics to take over. During the 1970s, he supervised 75,000 abortions at the biggest abortion clinic in the Western world, New York's Center for Reproductive Health. Meanwhile, the public speaking engagements in the medical and legal communities earned him the nickname the Abortion King. The power of Dr. Nathanson's pro-choice rhetoric manifested itself most strongly when he began serving as chief of obstetrical services at St. Luke's Hospital, also in New York. There he experienced what he later called the moral whipsaw of aborting a 23-week-old fetus at the request of one woman, while on the very same shift trying to rescue another 23-week-old fetus for a woman who had gone into premature labor and wanted her child saved. In the era of legalized abortion, personal choice had the power to determine the difference between life and death. The rhetoric of choice, in fact, leaves an easy-to-follow trail in the history of high court decisions concerning abortion. Attorney Sarah Weddington argued before the Supreme Court in 1973 Roe v. Wade case that a woman should be allowed to make the choice as to whether to continue or terminate her pregnancy. The freedom involved is that of a woman to determine whether or not to continue a pregnancy. We do not ask the court to rule that abortion is good or desirable in any particular situation. We are here to advocate that the decision as to whether or not a particular woman will continue to carry or will terminate a pregnancy is a decision that should be made by that individual. That, in fact, she has a constitutional right to make that decision for herself. The court essentially accepted Weddington's argument, ruling in 1973 that the right of privacy is broad enough to encompass a woman's decision whether or not to terminate her pregnancy. 19 years later, in Planned Parenthood versus Casey, the court reaffirmed this recognition of the rights of the woman to choose to have an abortion and obtain it without undue interference from the state. In this instance, a woman's right to choose meant that the state of Pennsylvania could not limit her choice by requiring that she first notify her husband of her intent to procure an abortion. The court reasoned that a woman's right to choose an abortion takes priority over any right that the husband or the father of the child may have, particularly in cases when a woman might suffer physical or psychological abuse from her husband, who would be upset by either her pregnancy or by her choice to terminate that pregnancy. Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, writing for the majority, explained the court's position thus: "These matters involving the most intimate and personal choices a person may make in a lifetime, choices central to personal dignity and autonomy, are central to the liberty protected by the 14th Amendment. At the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning of the universe, and of the mystery of human life." In other words, women have a constitutional right to define for themselves the moral status of a fetus and to choose whether or not to continue to bear a child. The same year that the Supreme Court issued this decision, a Texas abortion clinic hired a woman named Norma McCorvey. She was the Jane Roe from the Roe versus Wade case. The clinic's name, not surprisingly, was this: A Choice for Women. But the most revealing example of how effectively the rhetoric of choice could expand a woman's right to abortion came in 1999, when the Supreme Court struck down Nebraska's law prohibiting an abortion procedure in which the person performing the abortion partially delivers vaginally a living unborn child before killing the unborn child and completing the delivery. The court declared this partial birth abortion ban unconstitutional on the conviction that it imposes an undue burden on a woman's ability to choose dilation and extraction abortion. thereby unduly burdening the right to choose abortion itself. In 2003, Congress enacted a federal partial birth abortion ban, successfully seeking language that would pass muster with the Supreme Court. During congressional debates, Senator Hillary Clinton opposed the pending federal ban on partial birth abortion because it did not allow for an exception that would permit a woman to choose a late-term abortion for a child who would be discovered to be developmentally abnormal. That is to say, Senator Clinton attempted to strengthen the rhetoric of choice by citing an example in which she expected her legislative colleagues would agree that a woman ought to have a choice. If the child is malformed anyway, why not choose abortion? And if a woman is to have a choice to abort, then why not give her that choice even late in the game, say in the eighth month of pregnancy, when so-called partial birth abortion is often the preferred means? 4 years after Congress debated this controversial issue, a Florida court awarded parents a $21 million victory in a wrongful birth suit. That is to say, they sued their doctor for not detecting a genetic abnormality in their child prior to birth, arguing that if only they had known, they would have chosen abortion. Thus, what began as one woman's right to choose has become her doctor's obligation to advise her choice so thoroughly as to remove all reasonable chance that she would give birth to a child she would not want. And doctors do feel obligated, even doctors who know that the women whom they serve would never consider abortion. Our own family doctor knows that neither I nor my wife would consider an abortion, but clinic policy is clinic policy. And so our doctor handed us a free book which states in bold pro-choice rhetoric, being tested for congenital abnormalities is a personal choice. Some couples choose not to be tested for birth defects. Others find that testing and counseling can help them make decisions and consider options. Testing for birth defects during pregnancy can help a woman decide whether to continue her pregnancy. If she finds out her baby has a severe problem, she has the option to end pregnancy. There is no right choice in these cases. The decision is based on the values unique to each person. The choice that's right for one woman may not be right for another. Apologizing to us, our doctor nonetheless asked the required question. Would we want any of the first trimester screenings for Down syndrome or other complications that the medical community considers indications for abortion? When doctors worry about being sued for not recommending abortion, and parents worry about being burdened for special needs children, the temptation to eugenic abortion becomes unstoppable. Even pro-life mothers may succumb to the persuasive techniques, nigh unto coercive, such as being shown a video of how challenging it can be to care for disabled children. The right to abort a disabled child, notes one commentator, is approaching the status of duty to abort a disabled child. Still, the rhetoric supporting abortion rights emphasizes choice above duty. The proposed Federal Freedom of Choice Act clearly fits this pattern, both in its title and in its content. Section 4A reads, "It is the policy of the United States that every woman has the fundamental right to choose to bear a child, to terminate a pregnancy prior to fetal viability, or to terminate a pregnancy after fetal viability when necessary to protect the life or the health of the woman." Just as Senator Douglas, an antebellum Democrat from Illinois who ran for the U.S. presidency, promoted a pro-choice agenda of popular sovereignty with respect to slavery, so also another Democratic senator from Illinois running for the president, Barack Obama, championed the pro-choice rhetoric of freedom of choice. During his campaign, Obama promised Planned Parenthood that he would sign this bill if elected president. But beneath the pro-choice rhetoric is a coercive reality. Section 4B2 forbids any government from discriminating against the exercise of these rights in the regulation of provision of benefits, facilities, services, or information. This policy revision seeks to override any contrary, quote, federal, state, and local statute, ordinance, regulation, administrative order, decision, policy, practice, or other action enacted, adopted, or implemented before, on, or after the date of enactment of this act. For example, if the proposed Freedom of Choice Act becomes law, then numerous state laws requiring parental notification or parental consent before minors can have an abortion would be repealed, as would 24-hour waiting periods and informed consent laws applicable to adults. The Freedom of Choice Act also would reinstate partial birth abortion nationwide. Likewise, the Hyde Amendment, which presently restricts the use of federal money for funding abortions, would be repealed. American taxpayers opposed to abortion would thereby become complicit in it. A similar spirit of coercion animates President Obama's proposal to lift the Conscience Clause, which presently permits pro-life health care workers to abstain from participation in or referral to abortion procedures. Without the Conscience Clause, pro-life health care workers would face the dilemma of becoming complicit in something they find immoral, quitting their job, or else trying to keep their job while practicing civil disobedience. Senator Tom Coburn, an Oklahoma OBGYN physician, has vowed civil disobedience if Obama rescinds the Conscience Clause. "I think a lot of us would go to jail," he told reporters. The issue undoubtedly would find its way into the courts. And what then? It is difficult to say. But pro-life healthcare workers do have reason to worry. Consider, for sake of analogy, the 2006 New York court case ruling that a group of Catholic charities were required to provide their workers with health insurance coverage for birth control, despite the Catholic Church's official position against birth control. The lesson is this: religious freedom must yield to reproductive choice. Clearly, then, some kinds of choices receive preference over others in the coercive reality that lies behind the pro-choice rhetoric promoted by abortion advocates. What will satisfy them? Simply this: we must not only let them alone, we must somehow convince them that we do let them alone. What will convince them? This and this only: that we cease to call abortion wrong, that we join them in calling it right. And this must be done thoroughly, done in acts as well as in words. Silence will not be tolerated. We must place ourselves avowedly with them. The Freedom of Choice Act must be enacted and enforced, suppressing all restrictions against abortion as a moral wrong, whether made in clinics or hospitals, by physicians or nurses. We must pay taxes and fund their abortions with willing pleasure. We must pull down our pro-life constitutions. The whole atmosphere must be disinfected from all taint of opposition to abortion before they will cease to believe that all their troubles proceed from us, holding as they do that abortion is morally right and socially elevating. They cannot cease to demand a full national recognition of it as a legal right and a social blessing. Abraham Lincoln spoke similarly concerning slavery and its supporters in 1860. I will now apply the same analysis to physician-assisted suicide. A coercive reality lies behind the pro-choice rhetoric. Proponents of physician-assisted suicide emphasize a respect for patient choice as a key rationale. In brief, they argue that when a patient suffers from a terminal illness, particularly if it involves significant physical suffering, then that individual should have the right to choose to end his or her life before the illness finishes its course. They further conclude that the most humane way to exercise this right would be to secure the assistance of a physician who could prescribe a patient-administered lethal drug. In addition to patient choice, the rhetoric supporting this practice also emphasizes the concept of death with dignity. Dignity, however, in this context is defined in terms of personal autonomy. That is, a person's ability to direct one's own affairs in a manner of one's own choosing. Thus, even the emphasis on dignity functions to reinforce the rhetoric of choice. An emphasis on personal choice in the dying process has underpinned the right to die movement from the start. Derek Humphrey, for example, whose book Final Exit brought popular attention to the euthanasia movement in America, summarizes the case for physician-assisted suicide thus: while it is true that we have no control over our births, at least we ought to have control over our deaths. How can we claim to be free people if someone else's morals and standards govern the way we die? Knowledge gives choices. Sometime in the 21st century, laws will be altered to permit voluntary euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide. The identification of physician-assisted suicide as a choice which people ought to have the legal right to make pervades the broader movement that Humphrey has inspired. In 2003, his organization, the Hemlock Society, changed its name to the Society for End-of-Life Choices. 2 years later, End-of-Life Choices merged with a similar organization, Compassion in Dying, to form Compassion and Choices. Its website features the following quotation from clients, each deploying a rhetoric of choice as foundational to the euthanasia movement. Having the choice gives me comfort. Just knowing there's an option, knowing there's a choice, this has taken the fear out of dying for me. I felt alone until I called Compassion and Choices. They let me know I had choices and support. What a comfort that was. Compassion and Choices recently persuaded a Montana court to classify physician-assisted suicide as a constitutional right. Not surprisingly, the plaintiff, a 75-year-old cancer patient, summarized his attitude in terms of choice. It comforts me to know that my doctor can prescribe medication that I can take to bring about a peaceful death, that I can gather my loved ones and die with dignity in my own home. This is my personal choice, based on my values and beliefs. Barbara Lee, the president of Compassion and Choices, similarly summarizes the organization's mission in pro-choice language. We dream of a time when all Americans can live and die as a free people in dignity and according to their own values. Lee's advocacy group further identifies itself as a leader in the national Choice in Dying movement. That movement recently secured enough votes in the state of Washington to pass Initiative 1000, the Death with Dignity Act. As a ballot initiative, the Washington proposal became law when approved by the voters. But without the scrutinizing procedure that ordinarily is conducted in state legislative committees. Although the act itself contains 31 sections spanning 10 single-spaced pages, voters saw only the following summary on their ballots. This measure would permit terminally ill competent adult Washington residents, medically predicted to die within 6 months, to request and self-administer lethal medication prescribed by a physician. The measure requires 2 oral and 1 written request, 2 physicians to diagnose the patient and determine the patient is competent, a waiting period, and physician verification of an informed patient decision. Physicians, patients, and others acting in good faith compliance would have criminal and civil immunity. And I've underlined some of the key phrases here, self-administer, patient is competent, and so forth, indicating the pro-choice rhetoric. Opponents of the ballot measure sought a court order requiring that ballots identify the proposal's intended effect as the legalization of, quote, physician-assisted suicide. But Thurston County Superior Judge Chris Wickham ruled that such language was too loaded. In an attempt to be impartial, the judge also ruled out the supporters' preferred phrase, death with dignity. So oddly enough, the voters would check yes or no next to a paragraph that was forbidden from using the phrase death with dignity, even though the impact of yes votes would enact a law that was entitled the Washington Death with Dignity Act. Well, whatever its official description or title, favorable editorialists clothed it in the language of choice. This law would allow the dying patient to make his or her own choice about how to exit. Some will argue that it can only be God's choice. Proponents see it as God helping those who help themselves. Televised commercials supporting the proposal featured slogans such as, it's my choice or my decision. One commercial featured former Oregon Governor Barbara Roberts, suggesting that other states could follow the example of Oregon's Death with Dignity Act. She portrayed the law as benefiting patients primarily by expanding their choices. It has given them dignity, she said. It has given them choices. It has given them a sense of self-control. Another commercial concluded that it is compassionate to allow terminally ill patients the choice of ending their suffering. One may infer that the eventual passage of the Washington Act resulted more from the effectiveness of this pro-choice rhetoric than from a thorough understanding among voters as to what the full text of the ballot initiative meant. The Washington initiative closely mirrored the provisions of the Oregon Death with Dignity Act, adopted by the voters in 1994, as the nation's first physician-assisted suicide initiative. That precedent-setting act employed phrases that, however clear to lawyers, would leave most lay people befuddled. Except as otherwise required by law, notwithstanding the provisions of subsections 1 to 4 of this section, etc. Debates within legislative committees may have encouraged greater scrutiny of the Washington proposal. TV sound bites and editorial one-liners, by contrast, reduced the whole matter to a simple question of allowing someone the choice to die with dignity. Legal scholars who defended the Oregon law after its enactment similarly framed the argument in terms of the patient's autonomous choice about how to treat his or her suffering, and ultimately concluded that for terminally ill patients, respect for autonomous choices about how to best deal with their own experience of suffering validates physician-assisted suicide. But how many people who favor physician-assisted suicide, particularly those who voted yes without reading the full text of the legislation, how many of them recognize that the details of both the Oregon and the Washington law invoke significant state coercion against dissenters? Indeed, both the Oregon Death with Dignity Act and Washington's Initiative 1000 include several coercive provisions that limit the liberty of persons and organizations who do not wish to support physician-assisted suicide. These laws go so far as to require broad classes of citizens to actively promote a practice concerning which they may feel either neutral or opposed. Specifically, these laws coerce dissenters to become complicit in the following six ways. First, doctors are required to be dishonest. The Washington law insists that, quote, the patient's death certificate shall list the underlying terminal disease as the cause of death. This is despite the fact that death results from ingesting a lethal drug prescribed specifically for that purpose. Presumably, this provision seeks to protect the privacy of persons wanting to terminate their own lives through physician-assisted suicide without letting their close family members know that they have done so. Number two, citizens are denied liberty of contract with respect to any agreement that would impinge any person's access to physician-assisted suicide. The Oregon and Washington laws both state that any contract, will, or other agreement, whether written or oral, that in any way is contingent upon whether or not a person requests lethal medication from a physician is invalid. Number three, insurance companies are forbidden from applying a suicide exclusion of benefits to acts committed under this law. Under Oregon law, life insurance companies may exclude coverage for a person who commits suicide in the traditional sense of the term. However, Oregon law coerces insurance companies to grant full coverage for persons who self-administer a lethal drug for the purpose of ending their life in compliance with the Death with Dignity Act. The Washington law similarly constrains legal liberty of contract for insurance companies as well. Number four, state government officials are forbidden from using the term assisted suicide to describe what must instead be called self-administering life-ending medication. The Washington law specifically states that state reports shall not refer to practice under this chapter as suicide or assisted suicide. State reports shall refer to practices under this chapter as obtaining and self-administering life-ending medication. Number five, the state is prohibited from prosecuting cases of such self-administration of life-ending medication as any form of wrongful death. In Oregon, actions taken in accordance with the Death with Dignity Act shall not for any purpose constitute suicide, assisted suicide, mercy killing, or homicide under the law. The law reads nearly identically in Washington. Thus, family members of the deceased would have no case against the physician who prescribed lethal medication to their loved one, so long as the physician did so as set forth in the Death with Dignity Act. In other words, so long as the physician obtained informed consent from the patient at least 15 days ahead of time, fabricated the death certificate to protect the patient's privacy, and so forth. Legal immunity also is provided to home visitation workers from organizations such as Compassion and Choices. Home visitation workers who coach patients through the process of taking the lethal drug prescribed for their so-called dignified death. Number six, professional medical associations are forbidden from disciplining physicians who prescribe fatal doses of medication for a patient to end his or her life. I quote from the Oregon law, no professional organization or association or healthcare provider may subject a person to censure, discipline, suspension, loss of license, loss of privilege, loss of membership, or other penalty for participating or refusing to participate in good faith compliance with the Oregon Death with Dignity Act. Once again, the Washington law sets forth a similar restriction, barring medical associations from disciplining doctors who would intentionally assist their patients in achieving death. In summary, when it comes to death with dignity, the state's legal protection of one person's choice translates into the state's coercion of dissenters to become complicit in that choice, in the very act they loathe. Physicians must write dishonest death certificates. Freely contracting adults are no longer free to make a contract that limits in any way a person's access to such assisted suicide. Insurance companies may not exclude coverage in cases of self-administered lethal medication, although they still may do so for suicides not assisted by a physician. The state forbids its record keepers from labeling the self-administration of intentionally lethal prescription drugs as suicide, and prevents its Justice Department from prosecuting such cases as forms of wrongful death. Ultimately, state power goes so far as to limit dissenters' freedom of association, which arguably is still protected by the federal First Amendment. But until courts rule otherwise, both the Oregon and Washington laws forbid medical associations from limiting their membership to physicians who vow never to prescribe lethal drugs to their patients. Quite ironically, these laws have so exalted the patient's personal choice to die that physicians no longer have the liberty to form medical associations that are committed exclusively to the preservation of life. Could it have happened otherwise? Probably not. The pro-choice rhetoric, though expressed in terms of individual liberty, necessarily requires state coercion for its realization. Why? Because humans are social beings. We lack the kind of personal autonomy assumed by the death with dignity movement. Even supporters acknowledge this when they refer to their cause as aid in dying. Aid from whom? From another person, of course. Therefore, the state must ensure that other people make such aid available. Said another way, physician-assisted suicide requires not only a suicidal patient, but also a physician, an insurance company, a public records office, not to mention a mortician. A coercive state does not arise in a democratic society by accident. Rather, once a society becomes committed to guaranteeing for one individual a right to die, all other parties impacted by the seemingly private choice must play their appropriate public roles. If any of them refuse, the state, empowered by the collective will of the voters, will coerce them. Oregon, Washington, and Montana mark the beginning of a movement that already has strong footings in Arizona, California, Wisconsin, and other states. Indeed, nothing short of nationwide coercion will satisfy the death with dignity movement. What will satisfy them? Simply this. We must not only let them alone, but we must somehow convince them that we do let them alone. What will convince them? This and this only. Cease to call physician-assisted suicide wrong and join them in calling it right. And this must be done thoroughly, done in acts as well as in words. Silence will not be tolerated. We must place ourselves avowedly with them. The Death with Dignity Act must be defended and enforced, suppressing all restrictions against physician-assisted suicide, whether by physicians or state record officers, by insurance agents or family members. We must defend and promote death with dignity in the name of personal pleasure. We must pull down our pro-life constitutions. The whole atmosphere must be disinfected from all taint of opposition to physician-assisted suicide before they will cease to believe that all their troubles proceed from us. Holding as they do that physician-assisted suicide is morally right and socially elevating, they cannot cease but to demand a full national recognition of it as a legal right and a social blessing. Abraham Lincoln spoke similarly concerning slavery in 1860. I will next apply this same analysis to homosexual rights activists today. A coercive reality lies behind their pro-choice rhetoric. Advocates for homosexual rights in general and same-sex marriage in particular frequently frame their position in terms of individual choice and political equality. A documentary film entitled Pursuit of Equality favorably portrays the choices that numerous individuals made when they committed themselves to one another as same-sex partners. The film also celebrates the courage of San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom, who began orchestrating the civil marriages of hundreds of same-sex couples in February 2004 to challenge a state law that limited marriage to the union of a man and a woman. Some advocates of what often is called homosexual marriage or gay marriage prefer the term marriage equality. This shifts the discussion from sexuality to equal rights. You see, their opponents tend to emphasize the differences between heterosexual and homosexual relations, noting, for example, that heterosexual relations are uniquely capable of procreating offspring, whereas homosexual relations place participants at higher risks for disease. Supporters of equal marriage, by contrast, dodge these objections by appealing to equal rights for all persons, regardless of the personal choices they make. Behind this pro-choice rhetoric for equal rights, however, is a coercive reality that forges a social consensus in favor of homosexuality while marginalizing, if not also criminalizing, those who would dissent. This coercion can be felt in elementary schoolrooms, on university campuses, in a wide range of businesses that serve the general public, and in the legal arena, where the definition of marriage is under intense dispute. Consider first the example of elementary education. When California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger signed into law Senate Bill 777 in October 2007, the state's education code was revised significantly in favor of homosexuality, in a manner that also silences attempts to question or criticize homosexual behaviors. First, the bill deleted an existing section of the law that defines sex, quite commonsensically, as the biological condition of or quality of being a male or female human being. Second, it replaced that old language with this new section that was inserted to define gender as sex which includes a person's gender identity and gender-related appearance and behavior, whether or not stereotypically associated with a person's assigned sex at birth. Notice here the shift from a biological given to a psychological choice or perception. Third, the new law prohibited teachers from reflecting or promoting bias on the basis of sexual orientation. In this new framework, the law's requirement that schools also teach respect for marriage and committed relationships takes on a new meaning. The choices of homosexuals to develop committed relationships with one another must be respected, alongside the choices of men and women who join in lifelong marriage. Parents desiring a more traditional education for their children have the option of excusing their children from sex ed classes. And schools do have the option of skipping sex ed altogether. But no alternative curricula are permitted. A bold-faced statement on the official website for the California Department of Education plainly states, abstinence-only education is not permitted in California public schools. And I want you to keep in mind that under California's definition of comprehensive sex ed, it has more to do than just with condoms. It specifically requires that homosexuality be legitimized. The same website reminds schools that no guest speakers are permitted who would favor heterosexuality over homosexuality. All sexual choices must be presented as equal, or nothing can be presented at all. Similarly, a public policy ensuring equal rights for homosexuals at the University of California prohibits student organizations from adopting a position against homosexuality. Every registered student organization must accommodate all persons, regardless of religion or sexual orientation, as voting members eligible to serve as officers. In March 2009, just 1 month ago, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled against the Christian Legal Society, a student organization that had required its members to sign a statement of faith and to abstain from sexual immorality as defined by that statement of faith. The court sided with the University of California's Hastings Law School, which had rejected the Christian Legal Society's renewal application for recognition as a campus club on the grounds that the organization did not permit homosexuals or non-Christians to become voting members or officers. The court emphasized that the university's public policy trumps the organization's private mission. All groups, it said, must accept all comers as voting members, even if those individuals disagree with the mission of the group. The Christian Legal Society had argued that its First Amendment rights to free speech and free association were violated by a university policy forbidding them from implementing a mission statement that took a particular stance concerning Christian truth and sexual morality. The court tersely rejected and dismissed this argument, upholding the university's policy as, quote, viewpoint neutral and reasonable. Now, neutrality to the Christian Legal Society would mean that the university would permit both Christian and non-Christian groups, both homosexual favoring groups and homosexual disfavoring groups. In the court's construction, however, neutrality required full and open recognition of homosexuals in all activities of all student organizations. The Christian Legal Society must either change its mission and its bylaws to accommodate homosexuals or else forfeit its status as a campus organization. Similar patterns may be detected on other campuses. A student applying for a position of resident assistant at Minnesota State University discovered that one of his duties would be to refer students to the campus Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Transgender Center. The center defines its mission as, quote, providing support, advocacy, referral, and a sense of community to LGBTQQA students. That seven-letter acronym stands for Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Transgender, Queer, Questioning, and Allied Individuals. The center specifically seeks to eliminate negative attitudes toward bisexual, lesbian, transgender, gay, queer, and questioning people, also known as homophobia and heterosexism, through education and advocacy. The student seeking a resident life position was neither lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, questioning, or allied to any of the preceding classes, and in fact identified such attitudes and behaviors as sinful. He therefore withdrew his employment application in order to avoid being coerced into sponsoring sexual perversion. But when one needs gainful employment, then what other options are available? Those wishing to escape an employer's requirement to support homosexuality might choose to start their own business instead. But what sort of business? Minnesota state law requires that businesses whose services are made available to the general public must provide such services to homosexuals and heterosexuals alike. Thus, a restaurant owner must be willing to seat a homosexual couple at the romantic corner table for a Valentine's dinner. A hotel manager must be willing to rent the honeymoon suite to two women or to two men just as much as to a man and a woman. Although this state does not at this time recognize same-sex relations as marriage, some private organizations within the state do confer their blessings on such unions. A same-sex wedding party receiving such a blessing arguably is entitled to reserve any private reception hall of its choice, regardless of the preference of the owners. Again, based on the aforementioned state law that prohibits businesses that serve the general public from discriminating against persons based upon sexual orientation. Even churches, if they make their fellowship hall available for rent by some non-members, must be willing to do so for any and all non-members. As you know, a few states now have adopted same-sex marriage. Several other states permit same-sex couples to register for the legal title of domestic partner or civil union. The details vary from state to state, but in many cases, the rights and responsibilities associated with these categories approach those associated with civil marriage. In California, one of the most progressive states on this issue, the Supreme Court has identified only 9 differences between domestic partnership and marriage. And these minor differences have very little practical bearing on the lives of same and different sex couples. For example, individuals entering into a domestic partnership must be at least 18 years of age, whereas minors are permitted to get married with parental consent. But how often does that happen anyway? The marriage debate in California does not hinge on these details. Rather, it concerns mostly just the name. In November 2008, California voters adopted Proposition 8, limiting the state's official use of the term marriage to the union between one man and one woman. Homosexual rights advocates took the matter to the California Supreme Court, urging the state to confer the status of marriage on same-sex couples. But given the fact that California has a domestic partnership law that is almost identical to marriage law anyway, what's really being sought? Advocates for homosexual rights seek nothing less than a right to a positive self-esteem. Consider, for example, the following argument advanced by attorneys and students associated with Chapman University School of Law and submitted as a legal brief to the California Supreme Court. That is to say, these are professionals writing for professionals. The day of a lawyer's admission to the bar, should be a celebratory, joyous occasion. In her case, it will not be. Rather, when she, a lesbian law student married to a fellow lesbian, is asked to raise her right hand and swear to support the California Constitution, which was amended by Proposition 8 to limit the definition of marriage to the union of one man and one woman, it will be a painful reminder that her Constitution does not recognize her full equality. Worse yet, she will be asked to support discrimination targetedly, pointedly at her. Ms. Chang and her wife were devastated by Proposition 8. As stated in her declaration, for a week or so after the election, both Lindsay and I found ourselves unable to look at people, especially strangers, in the eye. Part of it was anger, but the other part was feeling ashamed and embarrassed. In summary, the statement in California's Constitution that only a marriage between a man and a woman is valid or recognized in California makes some people feel bad, since they would like man-man or woman-woman relationships to be called marriage, too. The people who feel bad therefore petition the Supreme Court of California to declare this portion of the state's constitution to be unconstitutional. An obvious difficulty with this argument in favor of the right to a positive self-esteem is that it requires a corresponding duty on the parts of others, namely to say nice things about lesbianism, to use nice words such as marriage when talking about the relationship that one woman has with another woman. Therein lies the coercive reality behind pro-choice rhetoric. When two women choose to unite themselves as lesbians, their fellow citizens must be coerced to consecrate that union with the term marriage in order to avoid injuring anyone's self-esteem. For those of you committed to heterosexual exclusivity, the idea embodied in Proposition 8's language that marriage is only between a man and a woman, the prospect of calling a lesbian relationship a marriage might make your stomachs turn. Nevertheless, the argument advanced in the aforementioned legal brief is that since your refusal to label lesbians as married couples makes their stomachs turn, your refusal no longer can be tolerated. I quote again from the brief. I feel like someone punched me in the stomach and knocked me the wind right out of me. I did not go to class that day. For the foregoing reasons, we urge this court to issue an order declaring that Proposition 8 is null and void in its entirety. And so I ask you one more time, what will satisfy them? Simply this: we must not only let them alone, but we must somehow convince them that we do let them alone. What will convince them? This and this only, that we cease to call homosexuality wrong and that we join them in calling it right. And this must be done thoroughly, done in acts as well as in words. Silence will not be tolerated. We must place ourselves avowedly with them. California's new sex education laws must be validated and enforced, suppressing all declarations that homosexuality is wrong or dangerous, whether made in high school or middle school or kindergarten. We must exonerate and celebrate their lesbian couples with unfeigned pleasure. We must pull down our heterosexual constitutions, not just in California, but even in Iowa. The whole atmosphere must be disinfected from all taint of opposition to homosexuality before they will cease to believe that all of their troubles proceed from us. Holding as they do that homosexuality is morally right and socially elevating, they cannot cease but to demand full national recognition of it as a legal right and a social blessing. Abraham Lincoln spoke similarly concerning slavery and its supporters in 1860. I have now applied this same analysis to homosexuality, physician-assisted suicide, and abortion. A coercive reality lies behind the pro-choice rhetoric. My intention this evening was to persuade you that abortion, physician-assisted suicide, and homosexuality cannot comfortably exist in American society unless the individual liberties of a significant portion of our population suffer severe restrictions. I trust that by now you see this to be the case in the United States of America at the present time. Despite the pro-choice rhetoric, a coercive reality limits the choices of those who would object to abortion, physician-assisted suicide, or homosexuality. The tendency is toward requiring everyone to participate at some level in the promotion or preservation of these contested practices. There is an obvious reason why this must be so. When political activists deploy pro-choice rhetoric in defense of choices that violate the natural moral order, they must, if they want to obtain and exercise the power to make such choices, soon resort to coercion. Why? Because few people will be willing to choose freely that which so fundamentally violates the natural moral order. Even those who do will not be willing to do so for very long. Natural law has its way of talking back. Just as gravity has its way of making that which goes up come down, so also the moral law within, to borrow Immanuel Kant's phrase, or the conscience, to use St. Paul's term, holds in check those who make immoral choices. And so it is today. Recall what Lord Mansfield had said of slavery. It would fade out of existence unless laws artificially preserved it. Even Stephen Douglas had to admit, in his famous debates with Abraham Lincoln, that if popular sovereignty truly were followed, that is, freedom of choice without coercion from the Supreme Court's Dred Scott decision, if popular sovereignty truly were followed, then slavery would never survive in the North, and it soon would fade out of existence in the South. Likewise, without state coercion to perpetuate abortion, physician-assisted suicide, and homosexuality, these practices would never amount to more than marginalized aberrations of an otherwise stable social order. Nevertheless, advocates for such practices, when they express their case in pro-choice rhetoric, claim that it is the opponents of abortion. They claim that it is the opponents of physician-assisted suicide. They claim that it is the opponents of homosexuality who resort to coercion. By outlawing abortion, aren't pro-lifers coercing all pregnant women to bear children rather than allowing them the liberty to choose for themselves? By outlawing physician-assisted suicide, aren't pro-lifers coercing terminally ill patients to suffer an undignified death? By outlawing same-sex marriage, aren't heterosexists coercing all people to conform to the standards of one sexual orientation rather than the other? Such are their arguments. And to each of the preceding questions, the answer is, in a sense, yes. But as I've demonstrated this evening, the alternative position also is coercive, despite its pro-choice rhetoric. Thus, we must face the real question. It's not a matter of choice versus coercion, but a matter of public norms and of social values. One side envisions a society in which the public funds abortions and all healthcare workers must be willing to participate, a society in which patients have access to physician-assisted suicide and physicians must record dishonest death certificates to protect their privacy, a society in which two men or two women can get married just as well as a man and a woman, while school teachers must teach that any of these choices are equally valid. The other side envisions a society in which abortion is prohibited, except for the rare emergency cases, a society in which terminally ill patients may be cared for by others, but they may not kill themselves, a society in which marriage is understood to refer to a uniquely heterosexual bond, potentially procreative, and in any case benefiting from the symbiotic strength of gender complementarity. Other participants in the debate envision yet another kind of society, but the point is that each society will rely to some degree upon state coercion for its stabilization. Just as property rights rely upon the punitive force of government to fine or else to imprison people who burglarize or shoplift. And so we return to the real question. Which ultimate values ought we desire that the coercive force of government would promote and protect? This, and not the pro-choice pretension of personal liberty, is at the center of the real debate. As our society wrestles with this question, numerous proposals will be entertained, a new law here, another court decision there. But just because the current problem we have may be coercive state policies favoring abortion, physician-assisted suicide, or homosexuality, does not mean that the only solution, or even the best solution, involves coercive legislation from the other side. Other remedies also exist. First, there is the possibility of favoring the particular social values which can subsist with a minimal of state regulation. Some scholars have argued that traditional marriage requires relatively little state intervention. The union of a man and woman quite naturally results physically in children and psychologically in the affectionate ties that hold a family together. The family is, in fact, a natural institution, grounded in creation itself, not requiring civil government to invent it or to define it. Unless one wishes to introduce an unnatural homosexual definition as the new basis for a new kind of marriage. The preservation and care of life, both within the womb and among those who are terminally ill, likewise finds its natural source in the created order that human societies throughout history have recognized as the lifelong union of a man and a woman caring for their children, children who in turn grow up to care for their parents. Although some state regulation may be helpful or even necessary, for example, to permit an emergency procedure that saves the life of the mother, even if it puts at risk the life of her unborn child, such laws will be far less invasive, far less coercive than those laws which guarantee to women in all circumstances the right to abortion by demanding of others some level of complicity in their act of killing. We need not delve into all the details now. It suffices to say that one can imagine laws disfavoring abortion, disfavoring physician-assisted suicide, disfavoring homosexuality that would be far less coercive than the laws favoring these practices. But I want to go beyond the political dimensions to the problem of the ethical dimensions. Do you remember Dr. Bernard Nathanson, the abortion king? By the late 1970s, he had come to regret his participation in the horrors of abortion. Ultrasound images had persuaded him that life within the womb is life. A fetus visibly struggles to avoid the abortionist's scalpel and vacuum suction tube. The abortion king thus became a pro-life leader, using his documentary ultrasound film, Silent Scream, to change the minds of others. Eventually, he even came to recognize the forgiveness won for him by Christ. How deeply it pains him that the pro-choice rhetoric he invented cannot be so easily retracted. And what about Norma McCorvey, the Jane Roe of Roe versus Wade? She too repented in sorrow and then rejoiced to know the forgiveness that comes from Christ. Though painful emotions still return, bringing with them doubts concerning God's love, McCorvey finds comfort especially in these passages. If anyone is in Christ, he is a new creation. Old things have passed away. Behold, all things have become new. 2 Corinthians chapter 5. If we confess our sins, he is faithful and just to forgive our sins and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness. 1 John chapter 1. How did this change come about in the hearts of Dr. Nathanson and Miss McCorvey? It was through gentle, kind and loving words and actions from Christian friends. Christ's love, communicated in actions and not just in words, transformed America's most infamous abortion advocates into Christian defenders of purity and life. Do you want to change the world? Now you know how. And so I encourage you to pray. Pray with all boldness and confidence as dear children ask their dear Father that the Lord, our gracious God, would turn toward himself even the hearts of San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom, comedian Rosie O'Donnell, and actress Ellen DeGeneres. May these icons of the same-sex marriage movement, like Dr. Nathanson and Ms. McCorvey before them, repent of their sins, receive God's merciful forgiveness in Christ, and be spared of divine judgment. And as for you, if you reject the pro-choice agenda for the facade of coercion that it is, then I hope you will embrace the pro-life calling for the compassionate lifestyle that it is. This means not merely steering a woman away from abortion, but providing her with food when she is hungry, clothing when she is cold, comfort when she is heartbroken, and encouragement from God, who provides daily bread for all and eternal life in Christ. If you don't wish to be compelled by the state to support a woman's choice to kill her child, then ask God to move you with love to assist a woman in raising her child. And likewise, for the terminally ill patient contemplating physician-assisted suicide, or for the sexually troubled who desire intimacy wrongly from persons of the same sex. Ultimately, it is not, as Abraham Lincoln so starkly put it, simply a contest between them and us, but rather it is a calling. It is a calling for us to serve them, to show them how the coercive reality behind their pro-choice rhetoric entraps not only us, but also and especially themselves. It is a calling to help them break free from the sorrow, from the pain, from the confusion, from the guilt that would drive them towards such choices in the first place. Please consider carefully what it must mean in early 21st century America for Christian people like yourselves to live as the salt and the light of the world.
The preceding podcast has been brought to you by Ryan C. McPherson, PhD. Dr. McPherson is a nationally recognized author and speaker who teaches college courses in American history, constitutional law, science, theology, and culture. To learn more, visit www.ryancmcpherson.com. That's www.ryancmcpherson.com.